Christ be with you. I'm Father Mitch Pacwa, and we're going through St. Paul's epistle to the Ephesians. In the last part of chapter 5 and the beginning of chapter 6, St. Paul gave us a basic principle: be subject to one another. And because of this basic principle, he calls us to be subject to one another in marriage and in our parent-children relationship, so that we can help each other come closer to Christ, and so that we can all be signs of Christ. Now, we see that St. Paul moves to another topic. It's still on the question of how we are to be subject to one another. But here, he's beginning in chapter 6, verses 5 through 9, with the issue of slaves and masters. To understand some of the background for this, you have to keep in mind that slavery was a major institution. It was more far-reaching in ancient Roman Empire times than it even was in our country. Our country had a terrible problem with slavery, to be sure, because this is something that even led to a very violent civil war in our country. And this issue divided Americans for many years, not only before the war and during the Civil War, but even in years later, we've continued to live with the effects that came from that slavery and the racism that was also involved in it. In the Roman Empire, slavery was different. It wasn't based so much on race, because they did not get all their slaves from Africa. They got their slaves from any race. They didn't care where they got their slaves from. They got their slaves from Europe, from Asia, and Africa, all alike. The issue was still the same problem that we had in slavery in this country. Human beings believe that they could own other human beings. They could in some way control and possess them. And that wickedness, that sense of false possession of another human being as a piece of my own property, was something that actually helped to bring down the Roman Empire. Sure, there were a few slavery revolts, Spartacus being the most famous, and we know about it especially because of the great epic movie that was made called Spartacus. There were other slave revolts as well, and they quite frightened the people of the Roman Empire, especially in Italy, where these slave revolts took place and were very violent. But we also know that slavery had a longer-term effect, because a lot of slaves in a society can help affect the whole culture. Slaves are not happy. What do they have to live for except maybe the hope that they would find freedom and they would have their own independence again? And a third of the Roman Empire was composed of slaves. A third was slaves. This kind of mass depression among the slaves had, of course, a negative effect on the slave owners. And I have read that some philosophers of history and some observers of history have suggested that perhaps the Romans got more and more into their debauched way of life because the slaves made them so depressed they were trying to overcome their own depression. And yet it was they who owned these slaves that caused the depression among the slaves, especially when, as I said, it was a third of their population. So this was a terrible problem. And in fact, many slaves did become Christians. They were oftentimes free to worship their own gods, though not always. Sometimes slaves were turned in by their owners, because the slaves who turned to Christ would turn away from worshiping the gods of that family. It's what the Romans called the gods of the hearth, that each family would have its own protective divinity or protective spirit, and that everybody was expected to worship the god of that family. You could worship your own gods too, but you had to show respect for the gods of the family. And some of the slaves were refusing to worship the gods of the family because, as Christians, they could only worship the one true God. And then there also was another problem. Sometimes the slaves would expect other Christians to buy them so they would be free. And in fact, Christians have done that since the earliest years of the church. They would buy slaves, give them the freedom. And even to this day, when we have slavery still going on in places like Sudan, where Christians and animists who are from the south of Sudan are being bought and sold as slaves by people from the north of Sudan. And that slave trade that goes on there in other parts of Africa and some parts of Asia as well is a terrible disaster. And so some Christians, even to this day, see themselves buying Christian slaves so they can set them free from that slavery. Then you can run into a certain problem. Might it not be possible that in the time of St. Paul, some slaves who belong to Christian owners would take advantage of their owners and try to get their freedom and would become Christians just so they could be set free, either by the church buying their freedom or by the slave owner? You know, people have such a desire for freedom. They have such a strong free will that they would do a lot of things to find that freedom. Freedom is a very important value. And people might just pretend to be Christians in order to buy that slavery. So there would be problems. And one last thing, too, to keep in mind. I mentioned that St. Paul wrote Ephesians along with two other letters and probably sent Colossians, Ephesians, and Philemon all together as a packet of letters. And what's the issue of the letter of Philemon? The issue there is that a slave who belonged to a Christian man named Philemon, who was also, and Philemon was a friend of Paul, this slave was called Onesimus. Paul came across him while he was in prison, and he sends Onesimus back to Philemon, but he says, look, Onesimus, your slave, has been a great help to me. Since I brought you to salvation, set him free so that he can continue to be of service to me, but to do so freely. So sometimes slaves might say, oh, look, Paul helped the slave get free. Let's become Christians so that Paul will help all of us get free. So these are some of the tensions that can exist and new situations that would occur in the slave owner society of ancient Roman times. Let's see how Paul deals with this. He says in chapter 6, verse 5, slaves, be obedient to those who are your earthly masters, with fear and trembling, in singleness of heart, as to Christ. Now, he doesn't say that slavery is an evil institution. As a matter of fact, it's something that existed in the Old Testament. But in the Old Testament, it had different limits than Roman law allowed. And since Christianity applied to just a few thousand people among millions in the Roman Empire, there was no way that the Christians were going to start fighting for the end of slavery. So he's not able to do that. He just tells the slaves, be obedient to your earthly masters with fear and trembling, but to do so with singleness of heart as to Christ. Let your service as a slave, even with the suffering that's entailed in not having your free will, let that be done as if it were to Christ. And not in the way of eye service as men pleasers, but as servants of Christ doing the will of God from the heart. So that you don't do this just to get noticed by the master, so that the master might toss you a few coins and you can save them either to buy certain pleasures for yourself or maybe even to save up and buy your own freedom. You don't do it just so that you please people, but do so you please God. And then he also says that you render service with a good will as to the Lord and not to men, knowing that whatever good anyone does, he will receive the same again from the Lord, whether he is slave or free. So that as the slaves are about their business inside their homes, where they belong to other people, they should do this service as if it's for the Lord, and they should trust that God will reward them for these good deeds, that God will be faithful to them, and if they do what is to help their owners, if they do what is to please their owners' best interests, and do what is right and just, then the Lord will be even more righteous and just to them. Then he also gives a command to the masters about how they should treat their slaves. He says, masters, do the same to them and forbear threatening, so that the slave owners, the Christian slave owners now, That's the only group he would be able to address in Ephesus and the other cities of Asia Minor. The slave owners have to do the same for the slaves, doing what's best for them so that they too would have a good life and that the Lord will reward the masters. One of the things that they have to do in forbearing threatening is not try to just impose power upon the slaves, but seek what is their best. Knowing that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven, and there's no partiality with him. So that you slave owners realize that the slaves have God as their master and your own. God is the father of your slaves as well as of you. So treat them with the respect that belongs to them as the children of God, the adopted children of God, and respect their dignity as human beings. Now, to be honest, this is not the best option. It's not the best thing to say, that we just let slavery go on. And unfortunately, this passage was even used in American history to make allowances for slavery continuing among Christians. But a couple other things we have to keep in mind to adapt this. First of all, remember, the slave trade itself began in the 1400s when the Portuguese made slaves out of the people of the Canary Islands. And as soon as the slave trade began, Pope Eugene condemned it and put under excommunication anybody who took part in the slave trade. And in fact, in earlier centuries, it was the Christians who helped to end slavery in the Roman Empire. It took a few hundred years for the Christians to have that kind of authority and power in the empire after Christianity was legalized. But eventually that happened. And we should use that as a model. Both the condemnation, the severe condemnation of the slave trade, which, by the way, was repeated from the time it began in the early 1400s all the way until its cessation. Popes again and again repeated that condemnation and the giving of the imposition of excommunication on those who practiced the slave trade. And that we have to also be very much in the forefront of helping to end such injustices and such things that go against the dignity of human persons. Never should we justify the enslavement of anybody else or any kind of bigotry because of race, because of creed, because of nationality. Never are we to partake in such injustices or justify them and say, well, that's just the way the world is. No, we have to be about the business to the extent that we're able to help end such injustices and to do what is right for people. But then a second major point for us to realize is this. Since we no longer have slavery in our society, we still have to deal with some adaptation of this. Maybe we don't have slavery, but some people are owners of companies, some people are workers. Some people are in management, some people are the labor, and there are different levels of management. In either case, whatever position that we might have, we have to do a number of things. A, treat people who are beneath us in terms of the workforce, those who are managers, treating those who are workers with dignity that belongs to them by their own humanity and the human dignity that inheres to them. Secondly, we have to do whatever is possible to pay a fair wage. Thirdly, if we're workers, we have to do everything possible to give a full day's work and service. So that instead of seeing slaves and masters, let's read ourselves as workers and employers, or workers and bosses and managers. So that each of us has this mutual respect for the Lord first. Secondly, for each other as human beings. And thirdly, for the work that we do, that there's a dignity in that work, and that we are to do everything possible to help one another live out that dignity as human beings and the dignity of the work that we have, so that in so doing, we give greater praise and glory and honor to God in our labor and in our treatment of our fellow human beings. The next section of Ephesians chapter 6 begins in verses 10 through 20. This is an extremely important section. St. Paul leaves behind the issue of how we are to be subject to one another. He leaves behind now the issues of family, husbands, wives, parents, children, slaves and owners, or workers and bosses. And now he begins to move to the issue of Christian life as spiritual warfare. Now he's warning us against being subject. But in this case, it's against being subject to the spirits of darkness. So let's take a look at some of the wisdom he offers us in regard to spiritual warfare. In verse 10, he says, "Finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might." This is the same thing that he had said much earlier in the letter. He calls us to a kind of strength in the Holy Spirit. Not a strength just of our own craftiness or strength of our own physical body, but a strength that comes in the Lord. And the might of his strength has to be our might. Again, as he had written to the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians 12, "It's when I'm weak, then God is strong. For in our weakness, God's strength is made perfect." So also, we have to have God's strength in the face of our own weakness. And when we are dealing with the spirits and the spiritual world, we have to realize that the angels who work for Satan, the forces of darkness, are more intelligent than we are. And frequently, they're allowed to have more power than we have. So let's not go around assuming that our own strength is going to be sufficient. I don't think it is. So he says, "Finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might." Now, what kind of strength does he suggest here? In verses 11 through 13, he tells us, "Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil." Now, soldiers in these ancient times wore armor. And in fact, our police still wear a certain kind of body armor. They still wear a type of vests, much lighter than the metal ones that the ancient people used to wear. But the weapons that our body armor defends us against are weapons that are stronger than the swords and the arrows of ancient times. So putting on this armor is something that we should also understand from our own world. And we have to keep in mind that it's not going to be the army of the Romans' armor. It's not going to be the armor that comes from American soldiers and their body vests and so on, or the kind of armor that our police wear. This is human armor that's good for its purpose against human weapons. But we are not dealing with that kind of enemy. We are dealing here, as he says, with the wiles of the devil. It's a kind of cleverness that is able to break through our defenses, and that we ourselves have to be alert to the way in which we are going to be attacked. And that alertness means we need God's armor, God's protection. Now, the first thing that St. Paul is going to do in verses 12 through 13 is point out the way, why we need God's armor. What is the reason for it? So we see here, "For we are not contending against flesh and blood." So this is not a war with other human beings. And sometimes we have to be alert to this fact, that when we have difficulties in the spiritual life, it's not just that we have difficulties with other people, but sometimes other people, whether consciously or unconsciously, might become the tools of the enemy of our soul, Satan. Sometimes people will be at the service of demonic forces. They might not even realize it, or they may. Sometimes there are people who try. I've met them. They've told me about it. They've tried to do harm to other people because they want to serve Satan. They'll say that. And we even call them Satanists. Other people will try to harm us because we serve Christ. And they won't realize that the tools of the enemy of our soul, the tools of Satan, but they might well be. And then we have to deal with things that are more general and out there. There's an evil that is beyond us and is more clever than we are. And this evil is what we are contending with. So, we are not contending against flesh and blood. But what are we contending against? St. Paul goes on in verse 12, against the principalities, against the powers, against the world rulers of this present darkness, against the spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Now, just as we saw early in the letter, in chapter 1, which is kind of the opposite side of this, notice how it's kind of balanced in St. Paul, where Christ has a name which is above every other name, and he mentions the powers and the principalities and the dominions. These are for the choirs of angels. And when we talked about this in chapter 1, I also mentioned that the choirs of angels, there are 9 choirs of angels which are mentioned in the New Testament. The angels, the archangels, and the seraphim, and the cherubim, some which come from the Old Testament as well as the New, that's 4. And then we also see some of these here. And the principalities, and the powers, and the world rulers, and also the dominions. These are 4 more of these 9 choirs of angels that are mentioned in this letter. And we have to realize that some of these angels are gods. They have stayed faithful to God. And these different choirs of angels with their different tasks, which I'm not about to go into. I don't know enough about it by any means. But these different choirs of angels with their different powers belong to God. Christ is over them. Christ is more powerful than them. Christ is not himself an angel. He is God, and all the angels are subject to him. And in fact, Hebrews chapter 1, verse 6 says, all the angels of God worship him, that is Jesus. So they are subject to him and they worship Jesus. This is a very important point, especially when you realize that you can only worship God. It must mean that they recognize that he is God. But there are some of these angels, like the archangel Satan himself, which are contrary to God. And not only the archangel Satan, Lucifer, but also some of these world rulers of the present darkness. You see, these are spirits who have a control over the darkness that exists in the world. And there are also these powers and principalities. They also have an ability to do things. And when people are dealing with exorcism, one of the points that exorcists look for to discern whether or not a person really needs exorcism or not is whether or not supernatural power is present in the possessed person or the allegedly possessed person. Not everybody who does evil is possessed. Some people might be obsessed by evil spirits, and they might be under a secondary kind of control, whereas the fully possessed people have their will taken over by the evil spirit, and they have these powers acting through them. And that doesn't occur very often, but it does occur. But more commonly, we have people who are under the control of the evil spirits. The evil spirits are able to present suggestions, and these suggestions from the forces of evil are suggestions to commit sin. And they're suggestions that become something of a habit, an almost second nature. And then you have some people who are trying to channel spirits. They'll be contacting spirits to tell them what to do, how they can make more money. And after they make more money, how they can become proud of it. And in their pride, they can go on to do other sins. This is some of the ways in which we see these evil spirits and powers and principalities, the world rulers of this present darkness, controlling people. And we have to be alert to the fact that people who are engaged in these, whether it be through the occult or through other means, are going to be opposing God. And if they oppose God, and if we work for God, if we stand for God, they're going to oppose us. So we have to be alert to that. And at the spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places, this is another element of what we're opposing, because they're not just spiritual powers down here on earth. St. Paul speaks of them as being in heavenly places. Now, what that means is that there are these spirits that are in, as he says, in the air. And he had an understanding that spirits were in heavenly places. Even Christ did. Remember how when the apostles came back from their first missionary tour in the Gospel of St. Luke, Jesus rejoiced with them and said, "I saw Satan fall from the heavens." And we also see in the book of Revelation chapter 12 that Michael and his angels defeat the bad angels and Satan, the archangel, Lucifer, and knock them down of the heavenly place, and they wreak havoc then on the earth. So there are different ways in which these evil spirits are even in possession of heavenly places, and we have to make sure that we do a careful discernment process of what is a good spirit, what is an evil spirit. The evil spirits will always lead us away from God, always lead us away from the person of Christ, and they'll always lead us to things that are wrong and untrue, whereas the Spirit of God will always lead us to the truth, in that we are dealing with all of these hosts in heavenly places. So what St. Paul then tells us in verse 13 is, "Therefore, take the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand." That we need this armor from God so that we can stand up against these forces. They're stronger than we are. We're weakened by sin. And we have to deal with the fact that we're also limited human beings with limited intelligence. But the armor of God is going to be given to us so that we can withstand against these forces. And what we're going to see St. Paul do in the next part of this letter is describe what that armor is going to be. For now, it's up to us to make sure that we seek to have that armor. We defended ourselves against evil by God's power, and we always seek to do God's holy will. God bless you.